We'll hear arguments first this morning in Dun & Bradstreet against Green Moss Builders. Mr. Garrett, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is a case about damages for defamation. The question presented is one that 10 years ago this Court in Gertz versus Robert Welch, Inc. sought to answer. What is the proper accommodation between the law of defamation and the freedoms of speech and press protected by the First Amendment? The Gertz decision recognized two very important things. It recognized that the states have a substantial interest in protecting the reputations of its citizens. Also, it recognized that absent actual malice, the states have no interest in awarding either presumed or punitive damages, and that the First Amendment precludes such awards. In its holding, it accommodated these two competing interests, and it held that a private defamation plaintiff who establishes liability under a less demanding standard than the New York Times test of actual malice may only recover damages which compensate him for actual injury. It is these constitutional rules prohibiting awards of proved, presumed, and punitive damages absent calculated falsehood that Petitioner Dun & Bradstreet asked this Court to apply. We believe that Gertz properly considered the tension between First Amendment freedoms on the one hand and reputational interest on the other. Neither Green Moss Builders nor the Vermont Supreme Court advance any reason why the states have a greater interest in awarding presumed and punitive damages against a non-media defendant who speaks about business matters or matters about the arts than a media speaker.
Give a definition of the difference between media and non-media. I can understand it clearly if a private individual writes a letter or makes a statement. That person as an individual is probably non-media. But what's your definition of non-media generally?
Your Honor, I think that's the rub in this case when it comes to deciding constitutional limitations on presumed and punitive damages. Obviously, the media could be defined as one who uses a medium to communicate information. And Dun & Bradstreet, much like a newspaper, does that. We hire reporters to obtain information which air subscribers will want.
Well, now, we have in Washington, I don't know how many, but I suppose it must be a great number of letters, like the Kiplinger letter goes out every week or periodically, sometimes on a broad range of subjects, sometimes on a limited subject like labor law. Is that media or non-media?
It seems to me, Your Honor, while the Kiplinger letter, like Dun & Bradstreet, may not be considered the traditional media, it is certainly media in that it is an organization that communicates information to its readers, which have a reason to know that.
That issue before us, counsel, you didn't bring that issue up here.
The media, non-media issue? That's the very basis that the Vermont Supreme Court ruled against Dun & Bradstreet in this case.
I know, but they held that you were non-media.
They said.
Did you challenge that in your petition for certiorari?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Well, we did not. We have never taken the position, Your Honor, that we were the traditional media, like newspapers.
Have you taken the position that you're media?
We certainly take the position that we're media for the application of the Gertz rules on presumed and punitive damages.
Well, of course, your first question presented in certiorari is, do the First and 14th Amendments of the Constitution permit private plaintiffs to recover presumed compensatory damages or general for libel against a non-media defendant?
That is correct, Your Honor. As I said, we have never taken the position that Dun & Bradstreet was part of the traditional media like the New York Times or the CBS. But we certainly are media in the sense that we communicate information to our subscribers.
Let's assume that this is a non-media defendant, and then does Gertz apply to non-media defendants? That's the question you put to us.
That is correct, based on the
Vermont. Do we have to get into whether Dun & Bradstreet is or isn't a media defendant?
Your Honor, I think it's
quite... You say we don't, really, in this question.
Well, I think it's quite correct that the constitutional prohibitions against presumed and punitive damages don't depend on the nature of the speaker or the subject matter of his speech.
Right. I thought you thought in order to win your case, you would have to convince us that Gertz applies to non-media defendants generally. And I think that's your whole argument, too, in your brief.
I think certainly that would win the case for us, Your Honor.
How do we reach that question if we don't know what a non-media defendant is?
Well, I think that's the very problem in the case, Your Honor, that it would force the courts to go back to basically the Rosenblum ad hoc test to make determinations on who is and who is not the media. And I think the most important thing is that the rationale for the Gerst opinion simply does not depend on those kinds of distinctions. The states have no interest in awarding presumed and punitive damages absent actual malice.
Against anyone.
Against anyone.
That's your argument.
That is our argument, but I would suggest to the court that if the court is concerned that a media-non-media distinction should be made in certain contexts, this is not the one to make it in. There may be areas where that would be appropriate, but not in connection with the awards of presumed and punitive damages.
But I thought your position was and is that it makes no difference who the plaintiff and who the defendant may be. If you sued me for libel, for example, the rule would be the same in your view.
That's correct. We do not believe that an individual could be awarded presumed damages because that simply is not proper for the states.
Right. And while we're getting at definitions, how do you define the difference between presumed and punitive damages?
Your Honor, in traditional libel law, presumed damages really took the place of compensatory or actual damages. Punitive damages, on the other hand, were more of a punitive punishment measure. The problem in the cases, however, Your Honor, is that they're both used selectively to punish unpopular speakers. And I think it's very difficult to make a distinction when it comes to the effect of presumed and punitive damages on First Amendment activities.
If you went back to the common law perception of presumed damages as being a substitute for actual damages, would that make a difference in your submission?
No, Your Honor, because the only rule we're asking for is that the jury not be told that damages are presumed. We are fully prepared to live with the Gerst rule that says a defamation plaintiff may recover all damages for his actual injury.
Will you sort of itemize what they may be?
Well, for example,
Under the Gerst formula.
Under the Gerst formula, for an individual, it may be humiliation, it may be embarrassment, it may be damage to reputation. It's a number of intangible things. For other plaintiffs, such as a corporation, it could be lost profits. It could be an inability to borrow money, which affected the business. It could be the business's reputation.
Yes, but you agree with Gerst that you don't have to prove actual pecuniary loss.
I agree with Gerst that for the private individual, he not prove actual pecuniary loss. And I think the Gerst rule says that you don't have to give a damage figure.
But even with respect to a corporation, there could be a loss of reputation, as in this case. I say there could be a loss of a corporation's reputation. In this case, for example, the problem was a report of bankruptcy, which doesn't do a corporation very much good, does
That's
it?
Correct, Your Honor. The distinction in this case, rather than proving a quantum of damages, is proving a causal connection between the fact that the report was issued and that the individuals to whom it was issued to took any action adverse to Greenmark.
Would you agree that any damages can be proved in this case?
Based on the evidence of the lower court, or could be?
Could be.
Oh, yes. I think damages could be proved. But what the jury could not be told was damages are presumed. I think that is the single rule that we ask this court to apply, as well as the prohibition against punitive damages.
Do punitive damages serve the same purpose as presumed damages? I assume not, but I'd like to know what you think.
Your Honor, traditionally, punitive damages have been used to deter conduct. That's the rationale behind them. I guess, technically speaking, there is a difference between presumed and punitive damages as far as their effect. However, I think in the area of libel law, they both have the same effect. When a jury is told that you may presume damage, we believe that by the very nature of that charge, you chill First Amendment activity.
A punitive damage award is a private fine. Do you agree with that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's a private fine, unfortunately, based on various state standards, which do not give juries much guidance. And we think in the area of libel law, the actual malice test focuses on the conduct of the defendant at the time he made the publication, and that is the correct test.
Would your view, and this is the last question I'll ask you for a while, I think, Would your view of punitive damages apply to a garden variety tort case other than the tort of libel, where compensatory damages can be proved?
Well, Your Honor, I think as the...
That's not the question before you, but I'm interested in your perception of the purpose and range of punitive damages.
Well, Your Honor, I think as the Court indicated in Smith versus Wade, punitive damages are a very troublesome area in the law. You know, I'm reminded of what Justice Rehnquist wrote in that decision from Oliver Wendell Holmes. You know, a dog can tell the difference between accidentally kicked and being stomped every day. Well, if you stomp somebody every day, you're going to chill their activity. And the real problem is that punitive damages often chill beneficial conduct, that they're too far-ranging, and that's a very difficult problem in the law, separate and apart from the libel area, Your Honor.
You have in private parties impose punitive fines.
That's correct.
Without due process of law?
It's a close question depending on the standards. I do not believe that's the case in the First Amendment test of actual malice. But when punitive damages, for example, can be given, as they were in this case, Your Honor, for something called reckless disregards of the interests of the plaintiff, that's a fairly broad-ranging state privilege.
Against Sullivan?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't the reckless disregard from Sullivan?
No, Your Honor. The lower court was reckless disregard for the interests of the plaintiff.
That language is...
Oh, certainly reckless disregard, but it's for a different interest. Reckless disregard for the truth in New York Times versus something called reckless disregard for the interests of the plaintiff. We believe, Your Honor, that the facts of this case highlight the very concern that the court recognized in Gertz. Presumed and punitive damages awarded by juries to punish an unpopular speaker. Here we sent a special notice to five people. It was corrected shortly thereafter. None of these individuals were a customer of Green Moss. As I said, we sent the retraction immediately. Plaintiffs called not one recipient of the notice to the stand to testify. There was no causal connection between our report and the alleged lost profits of the company. What occurred was a jury instruction that allowed the jury to award unlimited amounts of presumed and punitive damages. The jury was instructed that this was a case of libel per se, and that damage and loss were conclusively presumed. The court instructed the jury that it could award presumed or exemplary damages based on something called actual malice, which was never defined for the jury. The lower court found that its jury charge was misleading and granted Dun & Bradstreet a new trial. The Supreme Court of Vermont reversed, finding that Dun & Bradstreet was a non-media defendant and that non-media defendants, a state, could award presumed and punitive damages. What the Vermont Supreme Court did was focus on the status of D&B on what it termed as a non-media defendant and the content of its message. The Vermont Supreme Court fails to identify any state interest which justifies awards of presumed or punitive damages against Dun & Bradstreet any more than against a small newspaper or local radio station. The issue in this case, simply put, is this. If the Burlington, Vermont publishes Green Moss is bankrupt, they're entitled to a constitutional instruction that precludes the awards of presumed and punitive damages. Yet if Dun & Bradstreet publishes that same information to its subscribers because they want to know, they're not entitled to that constitutional protection.
Instruction that that no damages can be awarded even if they're proved without proof of fault?
Yes, we believe that we're entitled to the fault standard, and even Sunward, that filed an amicus brief in this case, said we're entitled at least to the fault standard.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we do not contest fault.
I suppose if you say that the Gertz rules don't apply against non-media defendants, the fault requirement would disappear too, I suppose.
That's correct. In other words, if that were the case, Your Honor, a plaintiff could merely prove falsity of the report and go to the jury on damages.
Go back to the old rule before.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Garrett, you suggest there can't be a difference between your client and a newspaper of general circulation. Supposing there were a statute that said credit reporting agencies that report of a bankruptcy must, in addition, state the source of their information. Would that be constitutional? I don't suppose you could compel a newspaper to do that, but could you compel a credit reporting agency to do that?
Your Honor, I think that the Miami Herald case answered for the newspapers.
Right.
I see differences, Your Honor, in connection with requiring credit reporting agencies, for example, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, from requiring disclosures and from requiring identity of information. To me, that is much different than awarding a presumed or punitive damages. And I think there's arguably a state and federal interest in the former, but not the latter.
I agree. It is, however, quite clearly, it would be a regulation of content. And you would nevertheless say it would be permissible.
I think regulation of content in certain instances like that could be permissible. I do think there's a distinction, Your Honor, in regulating awards of presumed and punitive damages based on the subject matter of the speech. In fact,
supposing I went one step further and my statute said that if you fail to do this, you shall be subject to a $100 fine, purely punitive.
And I think the difference in that, Your Honor, is you're not regulating the speech so much as you are the violation of a federal or state statute. And to me, that's different, because in my case, you're punishing speech. And I think, to go further with your question, Justice Stevens, the actual malice test of New York Times, and said further in Time, Inc. versus Firestone, was designed to avoid looking at the subject matter. You focused on misconduct. And I believe in Time, Inc. versus Firestone, the Court acknowledged that too often when we look at subject matter, we skew the balance of the state interest on the one hand and the First Amendment on the other. And that's what the Vermont Supreme Court did in this case. It skewed the balance between free speech and state interest in reputation. It allowed the jury to compensate Green Moss beyond actual injury. It allowed the jury to punish Dun and Bradstreet, not because of any showing of calculated falsehood, but simply because that special notice turned out to be false. The First Amendment rests on the assumption of the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse sources. There's no reason to permit defamed private plaintiffs in a business context or defamed private plaintiffs by a non-media defendant windfall damages, because the effect is still the same. It's punishment. The prospect of discretionary awards have a chilling effect on what is published and when, whether media or non-media.
Are you saying that presumed damages are a punishment? That certainly wasn't the basis in which the libel law developed. That was the idea that the kinds of injuries you suffer in libel to reputation are not easily quantified in dollar amounts, isn't it?
That's certainly the historical. But Your Honor, in looking at the jury verdicts, the Sunwood case that filed an amicus brief, $3.5 million, when a jury is allowed to give damages without any regard to actual injury, that can be punishment because it can be used to punish an unpopular speaker.
Well, you say without any regard to actual injury.
That's correct.
Are you saying then that damage or ruining a reputation is not actual injury?
Your Honor, that certainly could be actual injury. But in the business context that we're in, it's no different from proving damages for a corporation for breach of contract or any other thing. You have to come into court with competent evidence.
Well, but Gertz says you don't have to itemize dollar amounts, like pain and suffering, medicals, and that sort of thing. So, I mean, if you're going to have damages to reputation, it's going to be a lump sum type of thing that you can't relate to dollar testimony, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but you still have to prove a causal connection between the publication of the defamatory words and the damage.
Well, surely, but
that's what was lacking in this case.
Well, it may be lacking in this case, but your suggestion that any award of $3.5 million for damages to reputation must be punishment because it couldn't possibly have been amounted to that much, I would think would depend very much on the facts and circumstances of each case.
Your Honor, I would agree with you if no presumed damage charge is given. But when the jury is told damages are presumed, and then this court or any court reviewing that has no idea what the jury based it on. And that's the problem with the presumed damage charge.
Be proof of some damage.
There ought to be proof of actual injury.
Well all right. Let's assume that you can – let's assume you get one witness come in and say, I think less of Dun & Bradstreet than I did before. As a matter of fact, I've canceled my subscription, which ought to injure them. And And I know. But nevertheless, there's proof. there's proof of an injury. And now, is that enough for you, or would you have to quantify it?
I think that a plaintiff could come into court with a witness and say, my injury or my reputation has been injured. No dollar figure has to be assigned to that. But once an injury is proved, it doesn't mean that you can presume any amount of damages based on that. You may get damages which naturally flow from the damage to reputation.
And you really think you have to do the impossible, prove the amount of the damage?
No, sir. I did not suggest that, Your Honor. I'm merely suggesting that the fact that you have one witness that says the plaintiff's reputation has been damaged.
Well, he's proved injury. An injury.
And he may get all the damages for that actual injury.
Let me put this to you. Suppose the witness that Justice White has postulated was one of the directors of the bank where Greenmoss did business. And under examination, he said that this was discussed for a half hour at a meeting of the bank's board of directors, and that the conclusion was, from the president summing it up, from now on, keep a very close eye on Greenmoss Builders because there's something wrong here. Now, is that a damage or is it not?
Your Honor, it's very difficult for me to say that that's a damage to a corporation.
And that's why, perhaps, the law has said that certain damages can be presumed.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's what the law said in Girt. Certainly before that it did.
I'm talking about the law of Delaware. The common law of the states has been.
The common law of the states certainly has been.
Because this injury is so difficult to measure, that there is a presumption that is permitted by the jury.
That certainly was the common law prior to Girt, Your Honor. That's correct.
Well, suppose
if somebody comes in and says that I'm a corporation doing business, and you have circulated a statement that I'm bankrupt, isn't that damage? Per se, without more?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is.
Well, let's put it this way. It won't help them.
It may not help them, but it may not hurt them either, Your Honor.
You mean, would you do business with a bankrupt corporation?
If I got a notice that someone was bankrupt and I knew it was wrong and it didn't affect my relationship, I don't believe that makes any difference,
Your Honor. Would you buy any stock in that corporation?
If I knew it was incorrect, certainly, Your Honor.
Oh, I didn't say anything. Would you buy stock in a bankrupt corporation?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then that's an injury, isn't it?
If the fact of the publication resulted in that.
Huh?
If the fact of the publication resulted in that effect.
Well, I asked you, would you buy stock in a corporation that Dun and Bradstreet said was bankrupt?
No, sir, I would not.
Well, that's sort of an injury, isn't it?
If, in fact, it was incorrectly reported, and that was the result, yes, that would be a quantifiable injury, Your Honor. That is correct, Your Honor, if, in fact, that occurred.
Well, what's this case?
This case is there was no cause. The jury was allowed to presume damages, and there was no causal.
Well, isn't this presuming what I just said?
No, Your Honor. They were told damages are presumed, period. And there was no causal connection by evidence between the publication of the report and any action by the people that received it. No showing that anyone did anything toward Greenmoss as a result of that
report. What was the purpose of Dun & Bradstreet's publication?
To inform its subscribers about an event which it thought was correct.
The truth.
Well, that is correct.
The truth. And it was a lie.
That is correct. And Your Honor, it's no different than the lie in every libel case. It's no different than the lie in Girt versus Welch.
I've done, you can get punitive damages.
If you meet a certain standard, that's correct.
That's right.
Is it the same, really?
They pick up the telephone, call the clerk of the court where the bankruptcy was asserted to have been filed, and said, has Greenmoss Builders filed, or has someone sought a bankruptcy on them? Very easy to find out the truth, the fact, isn't it?
Your Honor, this is verifiable information, no matter whether it's published in Dun & Bradstreet or a local newspaper. It's a matter of public record.
Well, it's a lot easier than what a newspaper is frequently confronted with.
I would not think so, Your Honor, when it comes to reporting matters of public record. Both Dun & Bradstreet and the newspapers can make mistakes. They're reading the same document. And if I might, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Howman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, before commencing my argument, I'd like to correct what I think is not the evidence before this Court. And I'd like to start by focusing on this correction report. The correction report, which was a very important part of this case, we say was worse than the actual report of the bankruptcy. In other words, we were focusing on the conduct of this defendant after the publication. The corrective report, we said, was more damaging in many respects because it left creditors with ambiguity. The second point that I want to correct is that Mr. Garrett tells you that there was no showing that anyone did anything at the bank with respect to the Green Moss Builders. That's not what the evidence demonstrated. First, the evidence demonstrated that the specific loan request, and the Vermont Supreme Court found this, the specific loan request was immediately suspended. And we're talking about August in Vermont, when you have to start building. Secondly, in close temporal proximity to the report of the bankruptcy, a bank that had a perfectly good relationship with this construction company all of a sudden told that construction company, not only will we deny that request for a loan, we'd like you to go somewhere else for all of your banking business. I don't think that it's credible to say that no one showed any injury, no one showed any harm resulting from the bankruptcy.
Mr. Howman, doesn't that merely establish the proposition that if you're required to prove actual injury, you'll be able to do so?
No, Your Honor.
How does that go to the question whether you need to prove actual injury?
Your Honor, I think it focuses on the conduct of Dun & Bradstreet after the publication, which I think is a separate issue.
Which again, I suggest, just means you can win the case if you have to go back and try it according to their theory.
As far as Dun & Bradstreet's argument, their initial question before the Court, I think there are two different starting points. To Dun & Bradstreet, the existence of full First Amendment protection for these credit reports is a given proposition. And I don't think that they identify or associate themselves with a recognized First Amendment interest in the area of defamation. On the contrary, they start with the proposition that the common law of defamation doesn't have legitimacy. If there's no full First Amendment interest that Dun & Bradstreet can point to in a defamation context, the Court cannot reshape the common law because it feels the common law is imperfect or unwise. So in order to vest themselves —
Well, Mr. Howman, did you really answer Justice Stevens' question? Could you prove actual damages here if you had to?
In this case, I think we could prove actual damages. I think
— Do you think that most libel plaintiffs can prove actual damages if they have to?
I think that the presumption is necessary to assist private plaintiffs to bridge several causation gaps. I think many private plaintiffs may be able to prove some form of actual injury. I'm thinking now about Mr. Gertz, who on retrial testified that he suffered emotional distress.
Quantifying the — even if you could prove an injury, but and to prove the extent of it would be extremely difficult, I suppose, without the aid of a presumption.
Well, I think so, Your Honor. I think that that's where the common law has its most beneficial effects, because the intuition of the common law says that harm has occurred, and these presumptions assist the private plaintiff in demonstrating and getting to the jury the kind of harm.
What is the presumption you contend is appropriate? Does it tell us the amount of damages? Is there any presumption that concerns the amount of damage? Or does the presumption really go to the fact of damage?
I think the presumption goes to the fact of damage and not so much to the amount of the damage. And I really think the presumption —
so that if you're able to prove the fact of damage independently, then you don't need the presumption.
Your Honor,
doesn't it depend, counsel, on a jury's evaluation of, in effect, punishment? How vicious, how bad was the libel, or how mild and inconsequential was it? And if they think it was very vicious and very bad, they might give a large punitive damage, presumed damage, or if they thought it was casual and inconsequential, they would give $1, as has sometimes happened.
That may be so, Your Honor, and that's more in connection with the punitive damage than presumed damage. Justice Stevens,
how do you distinguish punitive and presumed?
Well, I think that in this case, for example, the presumed damages were equated with actual injury within the description utilized by the court in Gertz. Punitive damage has, if you will, the white knight aura, the private attorney general.
What do you think this large verdict was, presumed or punitive or both?
Well, this verdict was separated. $50,000 was actual, $300,000 was punitive. The large part was therefore punitive, the deterrence aspect. If I may, I'd like to get back to the question that you posed. You talk about the presumption. Gertz doesn't talk about the presumption. What Gertz talks about is the presumption of substantial damages. There are many common law presumptions, and I don't think Gertz focused on all common law presumptions in the defamation context. The common law presumption that I'm focusing on here is the presumption of causation, and I think that's particularly important when a business libel is concerned, because, as Mr. Garrett pointed out, there is a federal statute dealing with the Consumer Credit Reporting Act. But there is no federal or state statute dealing with business credit reports. Therefore, a bank, a creditor, does not have to talk with you about the reasons why your credit was rejected. The bank can simply say, and this was the testimony at the trial, the bank can simply say, we have no obligation to speak with you about it. Therefore, in business libel, it's very difficult to prove these kind of issues. But with respect to Gertz, I think that what Dun & Bradstreet is essentially focusing on in the Gertz case is they are trying to avail themselves of the strategic protection aspect of Gertz. Now, when I say strategic protection, I mean two things within the context of Gertz. Number one, Gertz necessarily protects, by way of the scope of the ruling, all media speech, irrespective of whether that speech raises a public issue and irrespective of whether the speech is of a general or public concern. The second part of the strategic protection of Gertz is that it protects false speech so that true speech can have breathing space. Therefore, it's a broad prophylactic rule. Here, the type of speech that's involved in this case falls within the strategic protection rule of Gertz. And on the type of speech, I would, without trying to split hairs, I would like to go back to the facts here a bit and point out that we've talked about Green Moss is bankrupt as being the statement that was made. The specific statement that was made, without splitting hairs, is that Green Moss filed for bankruptcy. That is, I submit, a purer statement of fact than the statement Green Moss is bankrupt. So the question before the court is, what strategic protection is necessary to protect business credit reports? And will there be ad hoc balancing if the distinction created by the court here is retained? I don't think there are valid fears of ad hoc balancing along partisan lines by saying that an admittedly non-media defendant should not receive full First Amendment protection. Dun & Bradstreet says, well, we circulate information, and therefore we're like the media. In other words, they claim they're closer to the line between media and non-media than perhaps some other non-media defendants. But in terms of the traditional First Amendment values in defamation cases, they aren't closer to the line. They are among the farthest away from that line, especially when you look at the rationale behind Gertz and New York Times, fostering public debate, robust debate about public issues. Self-censorship. I really don't think that self-censorship is a valid and legitimate interest when a company like Dun & Bradstreet is concerned. In short, D&B would simply have you return the Gertz decision to the constitutional garage, excise all reference in the majority and concurring opinions to the media and the press, and put forth a new, improved 1984 model Gertz with full First Amendment protection for every speaker and every form of speech, regardless of that speaker's need for protection and regardless of the significance or importance of the speech involved. It's the strategic protection area of Gertz that Dun & Bradstreet's particular speech here falls into, and I think the Court should recognize that aspect of the argument. When Dun & Bradstreet tells you that it's an unpopular speaker, what it says in its briefs is that it's an unpopular speaker because it's an out-of-state financial reporting company. This is not the kind of unpopularity the Court sought to protect in Gertz, even assuming that those features make Dun & Bradstreet unpopular, which I don't think they necessarily do, and the civil rules of procedures have avenues for avoiding that kind of unpopularity, to wit, removal. The message that
could
they...
Could Dun & Bradstreet have removed this case?
Yes, they could have, Your Honor. It was a diversity case, and the ad damnum was sufficient to take the case to federal court. The message that Dun & Bradstreet conveys is not of necessity unpopular. Now, Gertz talked about viewpoints and opinions being unpopular. There's no viewpoint and no opinion here.
Mr. Garrett, what damages did you ask for in your complaint?
When we initially filed the complaint, as I've pointed out in my latest brief, we asked for 70, there were two plaintiffs. Mr. Flanagan was also a plaintiff. We asked for 7,500 compensatory, 15,000 punitive. After discovery was over, we submitted a request to the Court to amend that ad damnum to seek $300,000 in damages. And as I've pointed out in the appendix.
Well, did they grant that or not?
The Court didn't act on it because under the Vermont procedure, the ad damnum is a totally irrelevant concept other than establishing the jurisdictional predicate.
And the jury gave you $15,000 actual?
No, $50,000.
$50,000
yes.
And $300,000?
That's right. I might point out that on that $300,000, many of the actions that we say were outrageous conduct occurred after the complaint was filed. The main point that Dun & Bradstreet ignores is that credit reports are fact-oriented, which contain no opinion and no editorialization. They are not opinions as to creditworthiness. Their own witnesses admitted this at the trial, and the evidence in this case belies the suggestion that they are opinions as to creditworthiness. And therefore, Dun & Bradstreet...
Give us an example of that. What did they do or say?
We asked their witnesses at trial whether this was an opinion as to creditworthiness, and they immediately say, no, we don't analyze creditworthiness. We analyze these facts. We have a rating system. If they fall within the rating system, then we give them this specific categorization.
Well, what is that? Yeah, hasn't that got something to do with your view of their creditworthiness, what category you put them in?
Well, I don't think it has to do with...
Well, don't your customers think it does?
Well, they said that the customers understand what those ratings mean, but it's not so much creditworthiness. It's things like size of assets to the value of the debt of the corporation, things like that. Basic, factually verifiable information. But using the broad rules of general application, as the majority did in Gertz, there's a very basic difference between media defendants and defendants like Dun & Bradstreet. A media defendant, as a basic proposition, simply doesn't have the incentive to publish anything that might lead to a libel suit, other than, with some media defendants, a sense of professionalism. Therefore, when a media defendant is involved, libel is not just the cost of doing business, like highway accidents and equipment failures are to a trucking company. The media can avoid liability without discontinuing its business by ceasing to carry or publish the material that creates the risk. Much to the contrary, Dun & Bradstreet has a tremendous pecuniary interest in publishing this material, this particular fact-based information. So for them, it really is a cost of doing business. For the media, it's not. In fact, on the strategic protection of Gertz aspect, the breathing space to commit error is very effectively rebutted, I think, by one of D&B's own amici. The association to which this petitioner belongs says the type of information companies like Dun & Bradstreet disseminate, and I'm quoting, depends for its success on a constant striving for accuracy because the specific markets served are highly sensitive to error. This suggests Dun & Bradstreet doesn't need breathing space. It also suggests that the kind of breathing space needed where free debate prevails just doesn't exist here. Dun & Bradstreet doesn't say that it will stop publishing this information, and it doesn't say it will tone these reports down. It simply says it will check them more carefully and then publish them. This is not, we think, self-censorship under the cases decided by the court. And given the admitted need for accuracy, even if this is censorship, the needs for accuracy outweigh it. In summary, I don't think that this is the type of speech that should get full First Amendment protection. I would like to address Dun & Bradstreet's arguments that the state has no legitimate interest in presumed damages. The only thing Gertz focused on, as I've alluded to, is the presumption of substantial money damages in a setting where Mr. Gertz offered no evidence of any actual injury at all. From that limited perspective, which was the only feature of the common law of defamation addressed by the court in Gertz, Dun & Bradstreet claims the states have no interest at all in presumed damages. In a business libel setting, that isn't so. Here, the amount of damages proved were limited to profit and out-of-pocket loss, so we didn't have the broader type of injury permissible under the Gertz rule. Secondly, the amount of damages that are proved under ordinary trial practice, introduction of evidence, cross-examination, contrary witnesses, that's all available to a defendant in a defamation case, and it was available here. Point number three, as I've talked about, the causal link between demonstrated injury and a defendant's acts may be one of the most important aspects of the common law of defamation. And I don't think Gertz addresses that. Fourth, where business libel is concerned, it's very difficult to locate the person who actually made the decision to withhold business credit. Especially where, as I've said, in business credit contexts, the creditor does not have to talk with you. On punitive damages, D&B's conduct, not its publication, is what caused this punitive award. And the Vermont Supreme Court's decision recognized that. As D&B's concession at the last oral argument demonstrates, punitive damages do deter. They do work. The punitive damages here were focused on the flaws in the information-gathering system that D&B has erected and the gross and extreme insensitivity and total lack of cooperation by that system with the person it harmed. For example, Dun & Bradstreet refused for no reason to give Greenmoss the names of the recipients of the reports so it could help itself cure the defamation. The final reason why Gertz should not be expanded to this non-media defendant is that what automatically flows from Dun & Bradstreet's position is that the Gertz doctrine will apply irrespective of the significance of the speech. So no matter how trivial unimportant or meaningless the speech is, it always will be deemed more constitutionally significant than the state's interest in reputation. That makes the First Amendment apply to the most trivial and meaningless speech imaginable while private reputation is sacrificed. I think core notions of the First Amendment would be obliterated in defamation cases because they wouldn't have relevance, as would, in the long run, the positive normative goals of our society in fostering good reputation. Because, after all, the rules of defamation are just society's statement about the importance and value of a good reputation. And finally, the person who subsidizes D&B's expansion of the Constitution is the defamed individual. If he is unable to obtain redress because of the First Amendment, he subsidizes defamatory speech.
But, Mr. Heilman, there's no suggestion he's not entitled to redress. It's he's not entitled to punitive damages or to redress unless he proves he's been injured. So there's no subsidy, is there?
I think so, Your Honor. If you accept Dun & Bradstreet's proposition that every presumption at common law is defeated by the Gertz case, a business libel plaintiff may have a very difficult time ferreting out the kind of witnesses that will establish the causation.
Well, that's my
point, Your Honor.
But if he does have the witnesses and can prove the fact of damage, then your subsidy argument collapses.
If he can show some kind of witness connection, but
and
it's
does
a difficult
he need punitive
proposition.
Damages to avoid a subsidy?
I didn't hear
does
the last
he need
part.
Punitive damages to avoid the subsidy? Put aside for a moment the presumed damages. Punitive damages, you certainly can't say punitive damages. A rule which foreclosed punitive damages without proof of actual malice certainly wouldn't be a subsidy, would it?
There was no presumption at all about punitive damages in this case. In fact, there was — the Court specifically made that a separate
element. No, but the punitive
element.
Damage issue is whether you may recover punitive damages without proving actual malice in the New York Times standard. Of course, you think you can prove actual malice, and therefore you may get your punitive damages. But I just don't follow your subsidy argument. That's all this is addressed to in this case.
Let me address the second doctrinal difference between Greenmoss and Dun & Bradstreet's positions. We say this case should be decided under the Court's commercial speech rules. Credit reports share the same earmarks and characteristics of the kind of speech the Court has previously categorized as commercial speech. Now, there's no special or necessary magic in the label commercial speech. The label's not important. It's the underlying characteristics of the speech which is important. Those characteristics indicate the Gertz rationale doesn't apply here. Indeed, in Virginia Pharmacy, Justice Blackmun anticipated the attributes that may control the resolution of credit report defamation by comparing New York Times with a credit reporting case, Grove versus Dun & Bradstreet. A fuller examination indicates those attributes do govern. Now, our argument starts from the recognition that communications concerning commercial transactions relate to the system of property rights rather than the system of free expression. They therefore operate in a separate realm of social activity. In this connection, the reasons that Dun & Bradstreet advances in support of its claim that it should receive full First Amendment protection under the Constitution can be utilized by the Court in deciding whether to give this form of speech First Amendment protection under the commercial speech cases. What function do credit reports serve? The answer is they inform private economic decisions, just like ads. Credit reports don't affect public opinion. Publications which inform and assist private economic decisions have been held by this Court to constitute commercial speech. Credit reports have basic characteristics that the courts identified concerning commercial speech. First of all, because of their factual nature, they are easily verifiable. Now, as we've heard, there's a critical need for accuracy with credit reports. That's also true with respect to the commercial speech cases, where it's recognized that such speech only assists the consumer in making proper economic decisions when it's true and not misleading. Factual data, like the information here, can be tested empirically and corrected to reflect the truth without jeopardizing free dissemination of thought. DNB has extensive knowledge of the business credit market. It's well situated to evaluate the accuracy of its data. Secondly, credit report speech is hardy and it's durable. Now, in an effort to avoid the application of the commercial speech doctrine, Dun & Bradstreet says, if you're not talking about your own product or service, you can't engage in commercial speech. That's a futile dividing line because it runs head-on into comparative advertising theories. For example, a Ford Motor Company says, our cars handle better than BMWs. I would suggest that Ford Motor Company probably has bought a BMW and has checked that out. That's comparative advertising, but Ford's speaking about something it doesn't make. The Bolger Young's products case expressly disclaims the suggestion that Dun & Bradstreet's made to the court here. I think as a final point, Dun & Bradstreet says that you must look at the interests of the speaker, the interest of the audience, and the interest of the target of this speech. We'll look at the interest of this speaker and ask Dun & Bradstreet, why should strategic protection should be afforded to this very durable, this very hardy, and this easily verified speech? Look at the interest of the audience. False credit reports are disastrous for the audience. They have no utility at all. Look at the interest of the target. Greenmoss is a company that never participated in the Dun & Bradstreet system, and thus, two entities in this triangle can't tolerate falsehoods. The third entity, DNB, has not shown that its voice will be stilled if First Amendment protection is not extended to it. Thank you.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Garrett?
If I could respond specifically to several points.
You have 5 minutes remaining. You have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quantifying damages in this case is no different for a corporation than in quantifying damages in any tort or other contract case. For example, if a corporation is suing on negligent misrepresentation or fraud, that corporation has to prove actual injury.
Suppose Greenmoss had been a listed security on the New York Stock Exchange, and within 3 or 4 days after this report, there was a wave of selling and the stock dropped to 25%. Damage to someone?
There may be damage. The question is, did our report cause that damage? And if a recipient of the report says, I sold my stock short because of that report, that's clearly damage, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't a jury be permitted to infer a nexus between the drop in the wave of selling and the report if it were shown simply that the stockholders had received the report? Now, that's damage. That doesn't damage Greenmoss directly, but it damages Greenmoss standing in the business community and with its bank and with a lot of other people, doesn't it?
It may well, Your Honor, and that evidence can be brought in to show that, and Greenmoss would be entitled to damages for that actual injury, and we have no problem with that.
Can you put a caliper on it and measure it in precise dollars?
No, but you can bring a witness to court that said he acted adversely because of that, and that's what we think the rule against presumed damages would at least require some causation.
What if he did? What if he brought that witness? Then I suppose you would say you still can't award damages without proof of how much.
No, Your Honor, we would be perfectly satisfied with whatever the state rules are for awarding damages.
Just bring in somebody, I've sold my stock because of this report. Now, how do you usually have to prove how much, don't you?
Well, Your Honor, in most injuries for a corporation, that's what damage is all about. They're injured in dollar and cents terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that could be proved by having an expert testify concerning what the effect was because of that stock.
So you would require proof of how much?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying how much, Your Honor, but there has to be something more so that a jury just doesn't speculate.
Well, here,
Mr. Garrett, the Vermont Supreme Court said that after the Dun and Bradstreet report, the bank put off any future consideration of credit to plaintiff until the discrepancy was cleared up. Now, if that's in evidence, do you still say you need a witness to come in and say that the bank's putting off credit to the plaintiff damaged the plaintiff?
Your Honor, if putting off the credit, in fact, damaged Green Moss, we believe that to be shown.
And you don't need to quantify the damages. Why couldn't a jury simply reasonably conclude from the fact that the bank did put off consideration that Green Moss was damaged?
Because a jury would not be allowed to speculate as to that amount any more in this context than any other context involving proof of damage.
Well, speculate as to causation or speculate as to amount?
I don't believe they can speculate under state law as to either.
Well, which do you think they would be speculating about here?
In your example, it may well be damage.
Certainly there's causation, isn't there?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. On that one piece of testimony was, and it was from the plaintiff's president.
Which the jury is perfectly entitled to believe.
All right. That's correct. And the bank officer, who was the only person that testified at the trial, said, and we quote his testimony at length in the reply brief, the day I got the special notice, I didn't believe it. I called in John Flanagan. He told me there's nothing to it, and that's the end of it.
Well, but the jury doesn't have to believe the bank officer. It can believe the plaintiff. And the Vermont Supreme Court said the evidence showed that the bank put off any future consideration of credit to plaintiff until the discrepancy was cleared up. I don't see where there's speculation.
It seems to me there's speculation as to proof, Your Honor. If I might make two other quick points. Certainly, the state doesn't have any more substantial interest in awarding presumed or punitive damages in a defamation case where actual malice is not shown than it does for fraud. In this case, there were five recipients. They could have been called to the stand, and none were. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted, and we'll hear arguments next in